You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, good morning and a happy Monday to you. We'll go ahead and jump right into the show. A series of recordings coming out of the White House. What do they say?
The Lead. Brought to you by Burge Ford, off the U.S. 60 and Mesa Drive.
All right, so the Trump administration pushing back a bit against allegations in an upcoming tell-all book from former Trump advisor and Apprentice contestant Omarosa Manigault-Newman. Now, promoting her tell-all memoir, Unhinged, Omarosa accuses the president of racism and misogyny. She also released a recording of Chief of Staff John Kelly firing her and audio of a conversation she purportedly had with President Trump in which he acted as if he didn't know she had been let go.
So she has a new book. I think it comes out tomorrow. Books come out on Tuesdays, if I remember correctly. So she is, Omarosa, that is, out there doing the Buy My Book tour. A book she calls Unhinged, in which she makes a variety of claims. Her claims are her claims. There's already people saying, I never said that. She wouldn't know that. She was a lying you-know-what beforehand. She's probably a lying you-know-what now. I don't think any of that changes, but she does have tape recordings of some of this.
Yeah, so when she's saying people said this and people said that, and they're like, no, I didn't. Well, can we go to the tape?
Let's go to the video.
Because apparently she has a lot of them and is slowly releasing them.
The White House believes there might be dozens of tapes of Omarosa taping. I mean, everyone from Trump on down. Who knows who she recorded things with?
Well, let's start with the very first tape that was released. Okay. We'll go in chronological
tape
order this
morning. Number one.
Tune, we go to tape number one. This is of Chief of Staff John Kelly.
Yep.
He pulled her into what's called the Situation Room at the White House, reportedly locked the door behind her. That's what she is saying.
She's alleging.
That, he confined her in a room. Frankly, I think that might have been more for her than it was for him. In the sense of, not wanting others to walk in on the conversation that he was about to have with her. And that conversation, well, she recorded it. Take a listen.
Can I ask you a couple of questions? Is the president aware of this?
Let's not go down the road. This is a non-negotiable discussion.
I don't want to negotiate. I've never had a chance to talk to you, General Kelly.
Yeah,
so if this is my departure, I'd like to have at least an opportunity to understand.
We can talk another time. This has to do with some pretty serious integrity violations. So I'll let it go with that. So the staff and everyone on the staff works for me, not the president.
Yeah, he doesn't get into the integrity violations. He mentions it more than once during this exit interview. One of the things I thought was interesting, again, in a room full of liars, who do you choose to believe? That's the problem. Is she said in the tape, this was the first time she had met Chief of Staff John Kelly. So their first face-to-face meeting was her firing. I thought that was interesting because he is the Chief of Staff.
But she's Omarosa.
Everyone in the White House works for the Chief of Staff, and that he had been there for a little while and she'd never met her boss.
But it also goes to show that she didn't have a huge role within the White House. Granted, she was there and she worked on the communication staff. I don't know how much.
But she was one of only the best people we hire, right?
I would have expected her to have
only the best people
with General Kelly. Okay, so that recording released yesterday.
And she was on Meet
NBC,
the Press with Chuck Todd. I thought he was, he kind of hammered her on a lot of this and she kind of kept going back to her talking points. She doesn't come across very sympathetic.
No. It's Omarosa, for goodness sake.
I mean,
she's opportunistic is
no
what
tears.
She is.
Yeah.
But again, not the first tape, or not the only tape, rather, because there was another one released this morning. Now, Omarosa claims that this recording happened after she was fired from the White House and was the day following up thereafter. That the president picked up the phone and called her the day after she was fired.
Mm-hmm.
She recorded it. D.C. is a one-party, it's not a state, but area in essence.
Only one person has to know
that they're being recorded. Omarosa, obviously doing the recording, knew it, and here's what that sounded like.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that. Damn it.
Damn it.
I don't love you leaving at all.
I don't love you leaving at all. I also thought it was interesting.
That needs to be the title of a new song, please.
Take a listen to the very beginning of this conversation, Bruce, one more time.
Marosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving.
I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving. I don't buy that. First off, you're not going to get it from the news. You should be getting it from your chief of staff. And I believe you
did,
in fact.
He gets everything else from the news. He doesn't get it from
his
staff.
No, I believe he got it from his chief of staff. He's just trying to save face. I mean, you hear the stories, again, I don't know what to believe, but the stories surrounding Omarosa in the White House were no different than the stories that surrounded her on The Apprentice.
I never watched.
She's a villain. She's opportunistic.
Mm-hmm.
She will backstab. She's ferocious. And so it sounds to me like the president's trying to get a little bit of cover. He's trying to have it both ways. Get her out of the White House, but still not ticking her off.
But claim that he knew nothing about it.
Right. Claim that he knew nothing about it.
Right.
But in that tape right there, Bruce, what I heard was, whether or not it's true, I heard a president, you know, like, trying to feel bad. You know, I don't love that
you're
leaving.
That was empathy?
No, I don't love that you're leaving.
I don't love that you're leaving.
Okay.
I love that line.
How quickly
I don't love that you're leaving.
Things change because that tape was released this morning.
Got it.
The president starts tweeting about it.
Oh, of course.
President Trump is lashing out in very personal terms against his former aide and loyalist, Omarosa Manigault Newman, calling her, quote, wacky Omarosa. He tweeted, people in the White House hated her. She was vicious, but not smart, nasty to people, and would constantly miss meetings at work.
At one point in time, he also called her lowlife.
He did refer to her, and he also tweeted this morning that she's a lowlife.
So you can't have both of those things exist at the same time. You cannot have the emotion of, I don't love that you're leaving. Oh, man. Really? You were great. Like, thanks for being here.
You didn't know that his loyalty is skin deep.
You
it's like the hairs on your skin deep.
You can't have this.
Marosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it.
No.
Nobody, you know, they run a big operation, but I didn't.
I have no problem with the concept that General Kelly came in. Remember when he came in, he was kind of supposed to put some professionalism into the White House, crack the whip, if you will, run it like a normal White House in some way, shape, or form. And he might have said, as a condition of employment, I'm going to make personnel decisions. And I'm going to make what's best for the White House, this presidency or whatever. And I won't fire your son-in-law or your daughter. Everyone else is fair game. It's possible. I don't know. And again, who do you choose to believe? Whose story is telling the truth? Trump also tweeted this morning, wacky Omarosa. Apparently, lowlife is not her nickname. Her nickname is wacky. He's running out of them. Doesn't he use wacky for other people? I think so. Wacky Omarosa, who got fired 3 times on The Apprentice, now got fired for the last time. Well, she was fired a while ago. Anyway, she never made it, never will. She begged me for a job, tears in her eyes. I said, okay. People in the White House hated her. She was vicious, but not smart. I would rarely see her.
Okay.
Yeah. So, question, when you surround yourself with only the best people, how did she get fired 3 times on The Apprentice and 1 time at the White House? Who kept hiring her?
You know,
real quick, just who's the person that kept hiring her?
There's so many things about this story. One,
asking
how did Omarosa record a conversation with John Kelly in the Situation Room? She apparently has plenty of other recordings, so that comes to a security issue. Second, she's trying.
Do you think they're discussing? Hold on. Do you think anybody in the White House? This is this White House. Is having secure, high-level national security discussions with Omarosa?
It doesn't have to be secure, high-level conversations in front of Omarosa. It could be a joke. It could be a word that either taken out of context or fully within the context, thinking it was being said in front of an individual and not being recorded, that could blow up. Here's the thing. Omarosa is not a sympathetic character by any way, shape, or form. She was a villain on The Apprentice. She's a villain in the White House. She's a villain outside of the White House. I call that an opportunistic. She's very opportunistic.
Well, somebody had to keep giving her a job.
And so now that she's got a book and she's trying to be like an anti-Trumper, she was the staunch Trump supporter out there until she fell out with Trump, and now she's trying to sell a book. And I just hope that like this runs its course and it dies a quick death, because Omarosa
is... She wants to stay in the news.
Yeah, of course she wants to stay in the news. She's opportunistic.
She said on Meet the Press that she heard the audio recording of Donald Trump on The Apprentice during an outtake or during a hot mic moment using the N-word, that she personally heard the tape. That'll be the next income. Not that it'll impact anybody. Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. Not going to change anybody's minds. I think this is going to be a drip, drip, drip of her releasing information as she tries to get some sort of revenge for being fired. The Lead, brought to you by Burge Ford off the US 60 and Mesa Drive. Online at burgeford.com. Are the self-driving autonomous vehicles safe for the roads of the valley? One group says, not yet.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Okie dokie. So, we've heard a lot of conversation about the self-driving vehicles. The big ones here in the Valley, Uber and Waymo, right, are the two that have been working on self-driving vehicles. We also know about some of the issues, including deadly issues that have come with these self-driving vehicles, where there is a new report out from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
And what they're saying right now, Bruce, is that they're a bit concerned. They're concerned that Waymo, which we've seen right here in the Valley. They say that they're going to launch this fully driverless ride-hailing service here in the Valley no later than December. Okay, so we've got that announcement coming from Waymo. But the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says we need to like slow our roll on this a bit.
Oh.
They have a report that they came out with. It is a 5-part study just released this week called Evaluating Autonomy. And in it, they say they've got a lot of concerns about the testing of these vehicles on public roads.
Okay. Yeah, and listen, I think there are a lot of questions, and we saw... You know, I don't know if there's a final report on that Uber fatal accident, but I remember that, you know, they blame some of it on the human occupant, but they also faulted Uber for its, I'm going to use the term software, and the sensitivity of the software when it came to the sensors sensing things in the road, and that they were trying to fine-tune it to a point because the cars kept stopping behind, you know, I'm going to use a paper cup in the middle of the road. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were trying to come up with, well, what should it slow down for? What should it avoid? What shouldn't it avoid? So I get all of that. I say we may not be ready yet, but I'm curious as to what standard they're holding autonomous cars to.
Well, they had about 18 different trials that they put a variety of different kind of, you know, driverless cars through, Mercedes, BMW, two Teslas, a Volvo. And they had some problems that ranged from kind of irritating problems, like too much braking for shadows. All right.
Like, for example, just too, I use the term sensitive.
To failures that were deemed quite dangerous. So some of them were done on the closed track, and they were taking a look at cars that stopped or failed to stop when there was a vehicle that would have been in their lane. So imagine, you know, you're driving down the road, and sometimes the landscapers, at least where I live in Gilbert, they'll literally park halfway in a lane as they're trying to like cut the trees and everything.
Yeah.
And you've got to slow down and get into the
go
other
around
lane.
Them, yeah.
So would these cars be able to detect them?
Or they would just freak out and stop and go, well, nope, can't go any farther.
Yeah. In their tests out on the street, all the cars except the Tesla Model 3 had instances where they failed to see the stopped vehicle and would have hit it without an intervention. So without a driver behind the wheel.
Got it.
They then took them out of the testing grounds and put them on what they say roads in hilly central Virginia. And none of the cars worked.
I like hilly central.
Flawlessly. Most of them would do a good job keeping in their lane, you know, but others, not so much.
I remember hearing some of the, and again, trying to understand the technology behind it. You use the landscaper. I'll use a city bus.
Okay.
Sometimes a city bus pulls over, and you can drive around the bus. It's still safe. It's a two-lane road. Or sometimes, like, the bus driver gets out and gets a coffee. I don't know what they're doing. I'm assuming it's coffee. And they were having problems with the autonomous cars. We'd come up behind a bus and go, well, we'll just sit here. We'll wait. And, you know, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, what's it, a few more minutes or whatever? But that's just not what people expect. They would, a human being would say, put your blinker on, get into the lane and drive around the darn stopped bus.
One of the biggest concerns that the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has here is the lack of safety information that are coming out of these companies. Mm. Remember how Uber and Waymo, they were lured, I guess you could say, to Arizona after Governor Ducey invited them because of the state's lack of regulation.
We created an environment. We enticed these companies to come to the Valley. And listen, I'm still supportive of this, Pamela. We enticed the big companies to come here and say, we will make it a business-friendly environment for you to test these vehicles.
Business-friendly is one thing, and I'm all for things being business-friendly, but I'm also for public safety. And so can you just let us know how things are going? I'm not saying you have to put regulations on them, but let us at least know what's happening. Because when we started to get those numbers out of California where Waymo could go, I don't know
how
the numbers,
miles,
but they could go
was?
1,000 miles without having to intervene. Uber could go 10. That was kind of the details that we were getting from those studies. That's important information. That's not regulation. That's just like, hey, folks, you may want to know this. I think that we should be able to have access to that information.
Yeah. I hear you. Not quite ready for the roads, but they're pretty darn close. Did you hear the story on Saturday? A luggage handler at Seattle Tacoma, SeaTac Airport, managed to get into a commercial airliner, take off, and then crash landed. We're going to talk a little bit about that and an expert who works with pilots and their mental state coming up next.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
A disturbing, a concerning, and a tragic event at Seattle Tacoma Airport up in Washington State, SeaTac, where Saturday night an airline worker, not a pilot, a baggage handler from my understanding, a guy that works on the ramp, managed to get into an airplane, stole it, took off, flew around, and then crashed into the ground.
This morning, we are starting to hear from that guy, from recordings that were taken inside of that airplane as he communicated with air traffic controllers. Take a listen to this.
I got a lot of people that care about me, and it's going to disappoint them to hear that I did this. I would like to apologize to each and every one of them. Just a broken guy, got a few screws loose, I guess. Never really knew it until now.
Yeah, bizarre incident. I mean, this guy works there.
That's him in the cockpit talking to ATC.
Yeah, you want to hear more of it?
Hey, pilot guy, can this thing do a backflip, you think? I think I'm going to try to do a barrel roll. And if that goes good, I'll just go nose down and call it a night.
Yeah, suicidal, obviously, which brings up some of like the biggest concerns for those out there, airline or airport employees causing mayhem
this guy. Yeah, I mean, you know, the TSA taking away your toothpaste ain't going to do anything about people who already have clearance to be in and around aircraft doing something like this. Joining us right now on our KTAR Newsmaker line is Dr. Aaron Bowen. Dr. Aaron is an aviation psychologist. Expert. First off, good morning to you, ma'am.
Good morning.
Is aviation psychology, is that a relatively new thing? Are we learning more about this now? Is this, I know there was always the physical concern. We had a mandatory retirement age for pilots, for example, worried about their physical health, but mental health becoming a bigger issue in the aviation world?
Well, you know, aviation psychology really started growing out of you know, in the 70s and 80s when we started seeing people make mistakes in causing accidents.
Mm.
You know, people who got fixated on little teeny things. It originally started out less about pilot mental health or airport employee mental health, but unfortunately, that's really the direction it's had to move in more recently.
Doctor, I want to play one more piece of audio from what we are hearing, the communication that this guy had with air traffic controllers. Take a listen.
Did you talk to McCord yet? Because I don't think I'd be happy with you telling me I could land like that, because I could mess some stuff up.
Well, Rich, I already talked to him, and just like me, what we want to see is you not get hurt or anybody else get hurt. So like I said, if you want to try to land, that's probably the best place to go.
You've heard these recordings from inside. What do you take away from the guy that stole the plane and was able to fly it for quite some time?
You know, listening to him talking back to air traffic control, and he even talks for a little bit with a pilot that the controllers got on to sort of help him mm-hmm. fly the plane if he needed it. This is not somebody, if I had to guess, who is just suicidal. You know, there's something else going on, some mental or physical illness, because he very much seems sort of disconnected from the reality of the decisions that he's making.
Oddly calm, I would say.
Oh, very much so. And now the calmness itself may not have been totally unusual, but he asks at one point to go see the orca whale that's been trailing its dead
right.
calf around the sound. That's been on the news for about the last week and a half. And just very disjointed communications and not connected to the present moment with what he's doing.
The likelihood that this even could happen was something that just really surprised me. I don't know why, but it did. This guy had the clearance to be out there on the runway. And I would say that the biggest, or one of the biggest threats that we would have in aviation is somebody from the inside,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily just trying to hurt himself, as was the case in this situation in Seattle. But I think we could learn a lot from this. What do you think?
Well, this is absolutely an incident that we as an industry are going to have to learn from, and those of us who do, you know, research work with the industry, because aviation's job is really to plan for the unlikely or the extremely rare, and that's why so many of the systems have double and triple redundancies and backups. You know, you don't just send out a single pilot to fly a 737. You have mm-hmm. two for a reason. We don't let them be alone on the flight deck. And so the fact that he was able to violate their own internal protocols and do all of these things single-handedly, it's going to cause a lot of reflection. And there's I would expect there to be some pretty substantial changes in how they track their adherence to policies there.
We're talking to aviation psychology expert Dr. Aaron Bowen from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, rhymes with biscuit. And Dr. Bowen, it strikes me that, and you just kind of touched on that a little, I'm going to go back to 9/11, and one of the criticisms was that there was a lack of imagination. We never thought anybody would do something like that. We never thought that they would use planes as a weapon like this. And this wasn't just a little tiny plane. This was a regional jet. It wasn't a big 737 or a big 777, but it still was about a 40-50 passenger RJ regional jet. You see a lot of them fly around here. I mean, the idea that plane crashing into downtown Seattle could have been catastrophic. And, you know, how do you anytime you and I fly, we see tons of people walking around on the tarmac, tons of people with access to airports. How does that change?
Well, you know, that imagination is one of the challenges, because to think like people who aren't logical are going to think, like in this case, it's really a challenge for those of us who are in, you know, the planning and the safety part of this business. But again, that's where we come back to, we watch each other. So you've got a ramp worker on the field. You should never have just one ramp worker on the field. They're surrounded by their colleagues,
mm-hmm.
and they're really trained to practice that sort of see something, say something. Where if I see somebody behaving unusually or not following a procedure or engaging in corner cutting or recklessness, that I speak up. And that's the same whether you're a pilot up in the aircraft or whether you're throwing bags underneath.
Yeah. We appreciate your time today, Dr. Bowen. Thank you very much. Again, Dr. Aaron Bowen, an aviation psychology expert with Embry-Riddle University, Aeronautical University. I mean, it's kind of one of those, well, who thought that the baggage handler could climb up in the airplane and manage to take off? Who?
Was that something people
were thinking? How many other people have access to airplanes who are struggling mentally, suicidal, or have even worse intentions? Seems like that might be a bigger threat than the amount of shampoo you're bringing on an airplane today. A huge win in court for a man that says Monsanto, the chemical company that Roundup weed killer, gave him cancer. We're going to talk about Roundup coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Pamela, I know it because I speak to some of them. You know, we have some farmers that listen to us. People around the valley, you see them, that grow crops. They're farmers. I know farmers back in the Midwest, so I've paid attention maybe a little bit more than the average bear to the whole Monsanto Roundup thing. But I think we need to start with kind of a primer as to what the heck is Roundup and why would anybody care?
Yeah, and you don't have to be a farmer to be invested in this story because there is a court case that just wrapped up. The details, I believe, are a landmark ruling. And Dwayne Johnson was a janitor, a guy who worked at the San Francisco Bay Area Unified School District. Okay. And he was responsible for keeping the grounds, you know, neat, tidy, and clean.
Which what they do.
Removing the weeds.
Oh, okay.
So he was responsible for spraying the weeds with Roundup.
Got it.
Roundup is a weed killer, okay?
Yes.
And he said that he applied Roundup weed killer 20 to 30 times a year while working as the groundskeeper. And he sued Roundup because he got cancer.
And he says it is a direct result of this pesticide weed killer that they were using.
And a lot of people have been watching this case for a variety of different reasons. It was the first to go through. There are now some 800 patients who are also suing Monsanto, claiming Roundup gave them cancer. So what did the jury decide?
Dwayne Johnson, plaintiff versus Monsanto Company.
A jury finding Monsanto knew about the health hazards of its Roundup weed killer when it was used by 37-year-old Dwayne Johnson. Johnson, diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma after spraying Roundup weed killer for 2.5 years, and sued the company.
Was the Roundup Pro or Ranger Pro design a substantial factor in causing harm to Mr. Johnson? Answer, yes.
The jury recommending Monsanto pay Johnson over $289 million in total.
Yeah, let's just call it $290.
Let's round up, for goodness sakes.
Pardon the
pun.
Yeah, exactly.
So this could be the first in many. There's some 4,000 people right now that have similar claims. It has impacted the stock of the parent company, Bayer. It's down over 10% already, as apparently investors think they're exposed to maybe litigation that could total into the billions of dollars, tens of billions, hundreds of billions when it comes to this product.
I think that this is a very important case.
Why is
one
it?
That we should all pay attention to because, yes, you do not have to be a farmer to be invested in this. Again, this is the stuff that's being sprayed at your kid's school. This is the stuff that is being sprayed around your HOA plan.
Yeah.
This is the stuff that is sprayed all over the place. And I've been watching Monsanto in this case for quite some time. I think that this is a landmark ruling because the question is, does Monsanto's Roundup cause cancer? That is the question that has been central to this court case. And this jury decided, yeah, in a very kind of relatable way, that you get a group of experts that are doctors or researchers or scientists that'll sit on a panel and they'll review information and then they'll come back with a determination.
Sure.
Well, that's exactly what happened. The process of proving cause in science is quite similar to that of a jury trial as well. Evidence is presented to the jury, which then renders a verdict. And the similarities between the tobacco industry are pretty interesting.
Okay, now that's where I thought it was really interesting, that we all kind of, I hope most of us remember, you know, the tobacco industry started with, cigarettes are health food. And it eventually evolved over time to find out they knew, the tobacco industry knew that their product was harmful, and they actively worked to suppress that information because they were trying to sell more cigarettes.
And not only that, though, but there were a lot of studies that were done in the 40s that showed a strong association between smoking and lung cancer, but there was never a randomized trial in humans. And if you look at studies involving rats, well, they didn't get lung cancer. But eventually, there were so many studies accumulating to the point where association was overwhelming, it couldn't be denied. I think that's what you are going to see with Monsanto and Roundup.
Could the floodgates be open with this?
And there's a lot of money at stake, so be prepared for this to get a lot of attention.
Yeah. About this, Dathan. I got two words for killing weeds: diesel fuel. Yes, but many people frown on pouring diesel fuel around their yard.
Vinegar works as well.
Does it really?
Yep.
I did not know that. Yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of the protest / riot / murder in Charlottesville, Virginia. The right versus the left. They had some protests yesterday, and one side didn't show up for it. We'll talk about what happened and maybe why the others didn't show up. It's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.